me in the direction that you want me to start. Is that correct?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
All right, today is November 7th, 2009. My name is Jessica Drysdale. I'm here with Jay Lutz, and together we're interviewing Daphne Delk at the Georgia Room in the Central Marietta Library. Okay, to begin, why don't you just tell me just a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you went to school?
My name is Daphne Darnell Delk. I grew up in Marietta, Georgia, a suburb of the great metropolitan Atlanta. Now, at that time, we didn't know Atlanta as we know it today. Grew up in a city that I thought was pretty, not sleepy, but comfortable. There was an atmosphere that was aptly apparent based on the black population and the white population. Growing up, we knew the differences, we were aware of the differences, and I think early on, through those that came before me that were educated in my family, they always reiterated to me what was important and what was going to make me successful in life. And I thank God for having those guides coming along, because it sort of prepared me for what was ahead. Growing up in a community that was sort of, at that particular time, very rural, and there wasn't a lot of, as they say now, city-fied attempts at getting information. The high school was, and I will start with where I started out, and that was in elementary. We had some very good teachers, and at that time, the black population of teachers would either go off to universities and colleges close by, and they were educated and would come back to the community and share whatever it was that they had specialized in. And we had those who were very proud of what they had accomplished, because at that particular time, that was like a prominent position for blacks, being school teachers and being able to give back to the community, I think, in some respect, besides the Sunday morning preacher. The teachers were pretty high profile, especially for us aspiring blacks. That was one of the positions that we looked forward to doing. The other one was in the nursing field. The nurses were pretty high profile. There was only one black doctor in the community, and that was Dr. Weddington. And he came to us from somewhere else, and I'm not very sure of his origination, but he was the only black doctor at that time in Marietta proper. I went to school with his daughter, and he was one of those who didn't accept less than the best. And his daughter's name was Patricia, and we often played together and talked about what we wanted to aspire to be. I remember some of the other community members who were involved in organizations in the black community, and we would look to that as moving forward. Never, I think as I was coming through, I never really thought anything about, as we called it, the white community at that time, other than we were two different entities operating individually. And being a part of where I was trying to get on with the business of doing better. I wanted knowledge, I wanted more. And as I grew in school and went from elementary level to the junior level, and then finally getting to high school, in the ninth grade, I realized that our books were not enough for me. It didn't matter if it was enough for the next person, but I was reading these books, and I would look at the years and I would go, this information is not going to get it for me. And I don't know where that came from in me, but it was something that touched off a different direction for me life-wise. I wanted information. I wanted to be the best person I could be. Had nothing to do with who I was as an individual, but inwardly I wanted to be the best that I could be, and I knew that at that moment I needed to get what I needed. Mm-hmm. Now, where that was coming from, I don't know. When we are called to do a thing, there's an inward drive. And that drive was letting me know that, yeah, you can do things, but you're going to have to reach for them. And I began questioning. I began to ask questions about our resources. I began to ask questions about the books from the teachers, from the principals. Were we getting the best? Was it comparable to the schools that were in the white communities? Were we getting the same books? And that's when I was told no, and I said, why can't we? I began to ask my mother to make sure she went to the PTA meetings because I wanted her to be my spokesperson. I wanted her to know that there was something that we needed we weren't getting, and to ask these questions in their meeting. And that's when it started. There was a lady in our community who at that particular time was considered what they call today a hairdresser. She was working out of her home. She had a portion in the back of her house, a Mrs. Catherine Grady. And when we would go over to her, she got all the news in the community because she was talking to all the different people that would come through her to get their hair done. And the conversations in that room were always so interesting. I would go to visit her daughter just to hear those conversations. And as I was sitting in there one evening, I asked her, I said, how is it that we can get the same books at our school that they have in the white communities? And I think her answers may have been, well, baby, you know, this is a different time. That's a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. It ain't gonna happen. And I said, okay. I went away, and her daughter and I, Treville Grady, who was the other young lady who went in with me in that first year, we started talking, and I said, you know, why can't we apply to that school? Why can't we go there and get what we want? And she said, you know, you always dream big. I said, always. I said, but I think we can get this accomplished if we stick together. So we kept pushing, and we went to her mother and we said, look, is there a way that you can get information as to how we can attend this school? And she said, yeah, I think I can. So she asked around, and of course, that's when we found out about the qualifications. We had to have a letter to apply. We couldn't participate in any of the activities first year, and we had to have a physical exam. So I thought, okay. We accomplished all of those things at that particular time, and it took a while. As we started to make noise, different people in our community began to question. And they wanted to know why we even wanted to think about going. And there were a couple of people who were very uncomfortable with the idea. And they began to express this to Mrs. Grady. I think when I went and I finally said something to my mom and my dad, I said, I want to go to Marietta High School. And they said, why? And I said, because I think that I'm getting inferior education at Lemon Street. And they said, well, how do you know? And I said, well, because I think our books are outdated, number one. Number two, I think our resources are not up to date. And I said, I'm not sure if our teachers are getting the same education as their teachers. And they thought about it. They talked about it. They talked with some of the other family members. And I remember my father coming back to me, and he said, baby, is this something that you really want to do? Because there's a huge wall out there that you're going to run into. And I said, well, you know, I want to try. So with that being said, he said, okay, I'm with you. And I think my mother was afraid, but she said, if this is something you want to do, we'll be with you. It was almost as if it was a destination that was already predestined. And the way that things came together, I couldn't have imagined, I couldn't have known that at that particular time I would be doing this and I would be going to the school in the white community. We got everything together that we needed. We submitted it to the principal at that time. I remember Mrs. Edna Lee was the counselor. She talked a lot with us. She gave us information on how we were to conduct ourselves coming in, because we were considered transfer students. And there were a lot of rules that you could not participate in activities. You couldn't get in any trouble. And it was something else that she told me, and I said to her,
do you know who came up with these rules?
It came from the school. It's all we knew. Mm-hmm. We never knew who actually enforced them. As I look back, I remember that there was rules around the physical education, football area, basketball, to keep kids from transferring because they were better or being recruited by different schools. So I'm assuming that we came under those guidelines. Mm-hmm. As I look back on things, and I'm thinking, well, you know, they weren't really out of line doing that. I think the biggest obstacles that we faced were in our own community. I remember going to the principal at that time, who was Mr. Woods, and he called me in the office and he said, you sure y'all want to do this? What's wrong with our school? And I said, Mr. Woods, nothing. There's absolutely nothing wrong with Lemon Street, except I feel that we can be a better school if we have better material. I feel if our books are updated, we can produce better students. I said, and if I can make that difference, then I'll do it. I said, this is me. This has nothing to do with my parents. It has nothing to do with anybody in this school. This was a decision that Treville, Grady, and I came up with. And this is what we want to do. And they just assumed that somebody was putting us up to it. Huh. It wasn't the case at all. Mm-hmm. It was a dream that we put into action. And after we got going and we started rolling toward it, before we knew it, the first day of school was upon us. And my father took me to the school, and I can remember before then there were meetings, and my pastor, Reverend R.L. Johnson at Zion Baptist Church, he came and met with my family, and we prayed, and he said that whatever it is that you need, if you are afraid, and I said, I'm not afraid. I said, you guys, I don't know what it is, but this is something I gotta do. I said, I don't know where it's coming from, but trust me, I'm not afraid. So I'm in the first day of school, and I'm sitting, I go into the school. I was given an entrance by the school personnel. You will come in this way. And I'm assuming that was because there was security in terms of police and detectives that were at the school. In fact, the first day of school, as I was told, never knew, they were undercover cops sitting to the left, right, in the back of me. Never knew that until maybe a year later. And I was talking to Miss Lee, and she said, you know, there really wasn't anything that was going to happen to you in the classroom. Now, past the classroom, we were a little skittish, she said, but in the classroom, you were sitting surrounded by cops. And I said, wow.
What was your emotion that first day? Were you afraid?
Apprehension. Yeah. I was frightful. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say I wasn't. This was a whole new world for me. Mm-hmm. It was different, but it was one in which I felt I had to go into. I wasn't afraid in that sense. I was more afraid that, I wasn't even afraid in the sense that I thought people would harm me. I was more afraid of how I would measure up. Will I be able to keep up? Will I be able to deal with them in terms of how much they already know? How far ahead of me are they? They're getting magazines in their homes. We don't get that. So I will be behind. And that was my greatest fear. I talked to Treville, and we discussed some things, and we had our funny moments. We had moments where we said, well, we do know how to run, so we can run real fast if something really happens. Mm-hmm. And we would break up over little situations like that. And her mother was very supportive. I have to give my hat off to her. And I went to her many times and told her how very appreciative I was of her backing, because she stood up for us when others in the community didn't want to touch it because they were afraid of the repercussions. So Miss Catherine was a real proponent to making sure that we made it in. What I didn't know was that my friend and playmate, Treville, was not going to be there with me the whole school year. And after we had our physical exams, within the second week of being in school, she had to bow out because she was pregnant. So, Miss Lee called me in and she said, do you still want to do this? And I told her, yeah. Mm-hmm. I said, I have no intentions. I said, I'm even more determined now. And she would call me in every so often, say, how are things going? Doing fine. She said, I don't get you. I said, I'm going to be fine because this is going to be. And I remember walking down the halls, and sometimes the halls would separate. People would just fly up against the wall to let me pass. And in my mind, I was thinking, at least they're acknowledging that I'm coming through, and they're not doing other things to me. I used to get the occasional paper ball, or people would spit in my path. They would move away if I sat down at a table in the lunchroom. In the classroom, they would move if I think when you're in an environment that you're not used to and people are treating you differently, you don't realize the difference until you understand the motives. And I had to understand that it wasn't all about me. It was about the differences that they were not used to. I wasn't used to a lot of things that I saw, but I had to deal with it. That was their way of dealing with it, and I understood that. I shared that with Miss Lee, and I told her, she said, well, how is that affecting your schoolwork? I said, it doesn't affect my schoolwork. I said, it lets me understand in my mind that it's not the socialization I'm seeking. I'm seeking the education, which is more important. And I've got to get that message to them, that I'm not so much wanting to be them or be a part of them as much as I want to be able to compete with them in a world that may not give me the same opportunities as they have. And I think once I got that down in my mind, I was able to deal with the little things that came along. And I would smile, and I would go on. And amazingly, there were students who would see that and knew that it was real. And they would come to me and say, don't worry about them. They would sit with me in the cafeteria. They would come out to school, or if there was something to discuss with the schoolwork, they would come and say, hey, let me show you this, or Do you understand? You did a good job. Or I like the comment you made in class. And I began to win people based on that. It was purely based on how I gravitated toward the educational portion of being there and how convicted I was mm-hmm. to get an education and not the socialization. And I think those two things were very different and distinctive. And when it was realized by the masses, she's real. She's here for a reason. And it's not to be a part of us. She's not trying to come in and take over and be with us. She really came to get the book portion. And I think once they got that, they started to come around. Diane Little, I'll never forget her. One of the smartest students, I think, in most of my classes. She was such a scholar that it didn't bother her to deal with me as a black person. She dealt with me on a scholarly level, making sure that you're okay. She would walk with me to classes, which, you know, really, that really set a tone for me. And I'll never forget her, and I thanked her as we grew in school, and I gravitated toward the senior year. We would often have conversations about when I first got there. And I let her know, I said, I really appreciate what you did for me. You made me understand that people are people. And I know where you're coming from. And it was examples of random kindness like that that just gave me more momentum to be the best that I could be coming through. The teachers that wouldn't let up, that were relentless and didn't give in because I was the only one. They wanted me to do it. And in order for me to do that, they had to stay tough. And I realized that. Math teachers, history teachers, Mr. Sechrist. He would put stuff in front of me and say, you know, this is what you're going to need out there. And it's only going to make you better. Mm-hmm. And because of him, I reached the heights I thought I never could reach.
Do you think the education that you received at Marietta, it met your expectations?
More than. It prepared me for a whole world out there that I didn't know about. Getting to college, I was able to run with the best. Mm-hmm. My areas of specialty in college became the sciences, and Marietta opened up that mindset to reach for stuff that wasn't the norm and to try something different. Think outside the box. The analytical skills expanded. It taught me not to fear. And I think that was one of the biggest lessons that I learned, that if you're going to achieve in life, you can't fear that which is unknown. You have to reach for it, try it on. If it fits, God bless you. If it doesn't, you got to try a little harder. And those were the things that got me through school and fueled me on to learn all that I possibly could.
And that's an experience you don't think you would have had you stayed at Lemon Street?
No, because I would have been in a group that they would have had expectations for me to do good. That's mm-hmm. the Dell girl. She's going to do good. And there would have been no challenges, no, you know, nothing that I would have had to really stretch brain cells for. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think this allowed me to compete in a world that's diverse, to understand how other people think, how they live. Because I mentioned in the article that I wrote for the Pitchfork that as I sat in that classroom, I tried to realize how different were these students from me, and how much difference was there that they were going to bring in the classroom. And there was never the fear that I couldn't do what they were doing. The fear was, will I be able to stay up with them because they are ahead of me.
Did you know any of them before that first day?
Never. Nobody. Walked in just as blind as a bat, not knowing, never having seen. We were not active in the different communities. We stayed our distance. They stayed their distance. We didn't play together. We grew up knowing that there were. Now, my mother worked for, back during those years, there were different jobs that were there. My mother worked for a family. And that family was the Colquitts. He was an insurance broker and very prominent in the community. He had two daughters, and I think, in fact, one of his daughters is in the insurance business today, Kathy Colquitt. But other than that, there was no connection. There was none. We knew them because occasionally when they would bring my mother home, the girls would be in the car. Mm-hmm. But that was it. We would see each other as different. I mean, kids do that now. They're going to look on each other and say, oh, she's different from me in some ways, but not really. Mm-hmm. The classroom was the equalizer. Mm-hmm. And I was able to make the classroom my, not necessarily war zone, but my zone to get in there and to just deal like they deal. If it meant I had to read more, I read more. If it meant I had to study harder, I did that. If I had to ask the teacher to stay after school, I would do that. Whatever it took to becoming what I felt was important for me to be that individual who was successful in life. Which brings you to a point where you have no fear.
Mm-hmm. Now, after you integrated, what sort of reaction did you continue to receive from the African-American community? Were they still hesitant?
It took them about, I think after the first year, when they realized that it really had occurred, it happened. I was still standing. I wasn't shot. I wasn't hanged. I was still going back to school. Some of the other parents then began to question because they wanted their children to have the same education. So I think in the second year, I think there were about four or five more that came over.
Had any of them approached you about that?
Mm-hmm. One was my neighbor up the street, John Patterson. His father, we used to gather at his house, and his father had musical instruments, and we used to play. I played clarinet when I was at Lemon Street, and John played a trumpet. And his father played a trumpet. His grandmother played the piano, and we would get up in the evenings, gather together and play these musical instruments. And his daddy would ask me, how you doing? You holding up okay? Are you afraid? Are you more comfortable now? And we would talk about it in people's living rooms. We would talk about it because they had, that was during the time that King was still very active in the civil rights movement in different areas. And he would say, I think John is wanting to come. I said, well, I want everybody to come, you know. I said, it's not that I'm feeling that lonely, but I think there's a lot that they can gain from the information. And I would talk about the things that we did in class, what I was learning, and he made the decision to let John go that next year. John was just a natural when it came to mathematic wonders. He scored so high on the SAT that it made me jealous because I thought, I got you over here, guy. But he did real good, and he earned his acceptance with his group that he eventually befriended, and the respect came from the fact that they saw the ability of the students that came over and myself making it happen, doing good in school, getting the A's and the B's, and competing on the same level. And I think that was more important to us, the competitive edge, than anything. And we used to get together at lunchtime, and I said, guys, this is where we are. This is what we want to do. We just want to be able to compete and to go out there in life and be good, productive human beings. So it was camaraderie. It was staying focused to getting the best that we could get, to reaching heights in different areas. We weren't all in the same classes. We were in different niches, and I would see them blossom with different students in different areas, and I mean, it would just give you a good feeling to know that we were doing something that was going to help people. But I knew that if I had stayed at Lemon Street, I may have been a statistic here at Marietta at that particular time.
After you decided to go to Marietta, did you, or should I say after you started going to Marietta, did you ever speak to Dr. Woods, Professor Woods at Lemon Street again after that, or was that the last contact?
That was the last contact I had when I first went. After I finished school, I did get a chance to speak to him again. He congratulated me. He thanked me. He realized that times bring changes that sometimes people can't control. It's inevitable, it's something that's going to be, and I think his idea was that if we were trying to move from Lemon Street to Marietta High School, he wasn't doing a good job. And I had to let him know, I had to say, Mr. Woods, it wasn't about you and the kind of job you were doing here as principal. I said, it was about my dreams in life. And I want you to understand that it wasn't an affront to the school or to the black school. I said, but now it's one school. And these kids will have opportunity to do whatever they want to. If they don't, it's because they don't want to. And he looked at me and he said, you know, at that particular time, I didn't really know what to think. I didn't think anyone was brave enough to do that. He said, when I saw you, I just knew we were getting ready to go through pure hell. And he said, I didn't know if I was ready for it or if you were ready for it. And I said, look at us now. Look at us now. So, yeah, you do. You come across people from time to time who will thank you and say, you know, we're so proud of you. And I said, no, I'm proud to know that others will be able to get whatever they need in this life. And, you know, so on and so on, the gift that keeps on giving.
When you, the end of your senior year, how many other students had...
Oh, wow. There were many students that came over and completed, actually graduated from Marietta High School. In fact, I was named Girl of the Year in my senior year, and I became quite the jokester in school. Is how I actually accommodated some of what was going. I tried to soften the fact that there was a difference there. There was not a physical difference, but a skin difference. And because of that, when I heard students around me laughing at stuff I said, it made me feel good to know that there is something that we can use to bring together unity. And it was nothing in my senior year to walk down the hall and get comments from students as they were passing or we were changing classes. Or what did you make on this test? Or how did you do this? Or, you know, it was a whole different world. It was like I was in this world now. Mm-hmm. There was no differences. I was a student. They are students. It's not about color anymore. Mm-hmm. It's about what you're doing and how you are making a difference.
When do you think that change took place?
I think it took place after my sophomore year. Mm-hmm. I think going into my junior year, because of the grades, because of the impact in some of the classrooms, just staying focused and shoring up and being the best that I could be. The other students were looking at that and they were saying, wow, she's real. She's not just here just because. She is trying to make something out of herself. And I think it happened after the sophomore year. Mm-hmm. Going into the junior year was a little bit more comfortable for me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like there was a point at which during the first year, I was sort of afraid on some days to go to school based on some things that I had seen or heard the day before. And I had to realize that this kind of stuff is going to happen. And I would talk to people in and around the community, and I said, this is, and they would say, Daph, that would have happened at Lemon Street. You got to get past that now. You're already in too deep. You're doing great. You got to find a way. And I would. And I would talk to people there. And
were you receiving threats or bullying? Is that where you were
referring to? That was a daily thing.
Okay.
That was a bomb threat every day. I mean, Iraq, Iran. No problem. I mean, every day at 2 o'clock, I could expect a bomb threat, and the police would be there.
And was it from the students, or was it?
No, it's from outside.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It was from outside. Mm-hmm. So, and that got to be the joke of the student body. After a point, they would come in, especially in the junior year. They said, "Okay, we need bomb threats today, so we can be out of school. It's pretty outside, and we want
half a day.
Half a day." Compliments to you, Daphne. But yeah, that used to be the soup of the day.
Did that continue throughout your high school career there?
That continued for about the first year and a half, mm-hmm. and then it just sort of. Mm-hmm. The first year, the first couple of months, it was really strong. But after then, it was like, it just got to be a habit. Mm-hmm. And you would think that would have been enough to make me skittish or to say, you know, I don't want to do this anymore. But it wasn't, because I knew it wasn't real. And it was always something in my psyche that would say, you know, don't worry about that. I got you. And I think it was that guiding force that kept me going, because it wasn't even about the principal's office, the guidance counsel's office. They were constantly trying to make sure everything was okay. And it was almost like at one point they were saying to me, you don't need us. You got this thing. You're okay. We're in your way. Mm-hmm. And I said, no. I said, I understand what you're trying to do, but I'm good. I'm good to go. Because in my mind, this force was always saying, you're going to be all right. There's nothing that's going to happen to you. Just keep it going. And I think because of that, I was able to just focus. And I think the biggest shock came with not being able to have my my co-partner with me. I think once I got past that, I was okay. Mm-hmm. That scared me. Mm-hmm. Not the fact that I was going to school, but her not being there with me. Mm-hmm. And once I got past that, it was moved forward.
How close during that period did you come to saying, I've had enough?
I think my mother asked me that one evening. She said, we can stop this anytime. I said, no. I said, I got to do this now for me and Trevia. I said, if I quit at this point, then it would have been for naught. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know what she was thinking about. I had no idea she was ever that close to a boy. I said, I don't know any of this. I said, but right now, I know I got to continue. I got to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And they tried. They tried to pull me at that point. Mm-hmm. But that was just the second week into the school year. Mm-hmm. But
did she continue to support you through that first year?
Travelle,
yeah.
She would often ask me, was everything going okay? She constantly apologized. And I said, life happens. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be this way. And then she kind of bowed out. I haven't seen her in years. I would call her mother and ask about her. We saw each other maybe after college. Mm-hmm. I saw her then, and I asked how things were going. And I think she was trying to do something career-wise, but mm-hmm. I didn't get too much into it because she still wore that face of shame. Mm-hmm. And I told her, you got to get past that.
Sure.
I said, get on with your life and get past that. Mm-hmm. So I haven't seen or heard from her in years.
Now, after you graduated, or when you graduated, mm-hmm. how did that feel to be the first?
It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was awesome. The other students that came over with me, it was unreal. I mean, you could see the tears, you could see the parents in the audience, and it was like a feeling that you think back from this point to the graduation cap. And as all of that was happening, as we were preparing for it, because Mr. Secrets was a big part of that. He says, okay, now that you're going to be wearing the blue and the white, and you're going to be marching down the aisles, we'll probably never see you again. And I said, well, maybe you'll hear about me. So it was something. A lot of the people in my community, I mean, it was like one whole episode of congratulations, parties. They wanted to let me know how much they appreciated my efforts, and that they were glad that their kids came along and went on and completed. And I mean, it was just the fuel that you need. It was that rocket force that you constantly want to hear about in life. Making impact, making something different, helping people who can't help themselves, giving back when you know you've had the opportunity for something. It's just the fact that you can give and help somebody else. And that has kind of been my philosophy in life.
Okay, while you were at Marietta, I mm-hmm. believe, actually the year says it right, 1966, started to get African-American teachers there.
Yes.
And I'm assuming one of them was Mr. Walker?
Yes.
Can you talk a little about your relationship with him?
I can't remember a whole lot, but I do know that there was just, it was so much pride. And he was like, we finally made it. We got some teachers over here. There were several that stand out. And I think just being able to walk, I think the biggest excitement was to be able to walk past the classroom, look in, and see Mr. Walker, and I think there was the home economics teacher, what was her name? I want to say Mrs. Williams. But to see her over there and to know that I was feeling homey. I was feeling like I was back in my environment to a degree. But yet I was being reinforced in the new environment because they had come to join me. Mm-hmm. And I think that was amazing.
Did they ever come to you and just talk about, you know, your role as being the first and then maybe their role as being the first?
That was done in church.
Was it?
Yeah, a lot of times there would be groups of people that would gather and we would discuss what occurred, what happened during that time, how was it, talking to the students who were coming after me to get them to understand the necessity for education, the need to focus and to want something badly enough that you'll stay no matter what the circumstances. Reaching heights that you never thought you could reach. Making
Okay, we're good.
Okay. And I think, I'm trying to remember what we were talking about now. Getting, actually impressioning the young folks in terms of what their needs would be futuristically. And right now I'm involved very big with our Sunday school area. In fact, we had a teleconference call this morning based on recruiting for the young people, because that seems to be a very dull area for them. So we have to do things that are really exciting and creative in teaching. And that was the other thing. The journey has taken me across lines. I remember teaching for a portion of time because I wanted to give back. I kept my mother for a period of time before her death. She had Alzheimer's. And I remember the rigors of dealing with her, knowing that I had known her in a different capacity, mm-hmm. and trying to make sure that she was comfortable, not knowing how much she remembered about me or the rest of the family. So after she passed in 95, I realized that I needed a break because I had done that. I was managing our processing area at Quest at night and had done so for maybe about 5 or 6 years. And I was also taking care of her after I would get off from work during the day until I was able to get hospice to kick in. I was burned out. So I took off from the job, and for about a year, I did nothing. I was trying to make a decision as to whether I wanted to go back to school, because I started to work on a master's in nursing. And I was trying to make the decision whether I wanted to complete that master's or teach, because I said at some point, you got to let these young people know what you know. And I started teaching. My sister-in-law was principal at this elementary school in Atlanta. And I said, you know, can you get me in the sub or whatever? And I was only going to sub at first, but the classroom that I took over, the teacher had a baby and went into some complications and ended up staying out the whole year. So I didn't have a fifth grade class the whole year. So it was interesting. It was educational. I realized that there was a lot of work to do in education. I realized that that was not going to be my full-time job after that point. I knew I needed to move into a different area, so I paid my dues back to teaching with the fifth graders and moved on. It's amazing how you shift from thing to thing in life, and I was listening at you tell me about, you know, how your husband got his and now you're working on yours. And the family is involved and you have to take time off. Different things. I never married because I was always so involved. And I have nieces and nephews now who will say, you were more of a mother to us, because my whole angle was for them to get what they needed. I have a nephew who finished Harvard, and he's working on an ambassadorship in Washington now. I have a nephew, three of them finished Morehouse, and one is working on a kinesiology degree at Auburn, a master's, and then the other one is in music. I have a niece who is working for FDA. There are other nieces and nephews who are doing their own thing, and some of them we don't try to recognize because of what they're not doing, but we still love them the same.
Sure.
But just the influence over the years has been amazing, and it wouldn't have been had I not had the opportunity to actually be a part of Marietta High School. I hear a lot of comments about the school even today, and they're all very positive. I'm so very proud of this high school. I don't know what to do at times because I see myself on the cornerstone, and I say that's one of the best schools in Cobb County, and I will say it until the grave, but very proud of what they're doing. The students that they're putting out, and will always remember them as a stellar school for what they did for me.
Mm-hmm. Was there anybody in particular who supported you through your way, during your journey through Marietta?
There was students and teachers that were very important to me. Like I say, Miss Lee was very important. The principal at that time, I can't remember his name, but he was very supportive. I go back to the ones that are so very prominent in my mind. Diane Little, very inspiring.
Mr. Secret.
Mr. Secret will always stick out. There was a math teacher, and I can't think of it. I thought I had brought the other yearbook in, and I was going to show you some of the pictures of different teachers. They're not in this book because they've gone on, I guess. But just an amazing cast of characters who don't actually know how much they mean to me at this point in life, even now, because of what they did. Because they went out on a limb. Now, trust and know that at that particular time in history, there were controversial groups all around Cobb County. The Klan was stationed in Cobb County. David Dukes had a headquarters in a house not too far from the school, down from the hospital on, I can't think of the main thoroughfare there right now, but Church Street. It was Church Street. And the danger that existed in others' minds was not the danger in my mind. I saw them, knew what the possibilities were, but it never occurred to me that they would ever come, we would ever clash. Mm-hmm. It was never there. They showed up. They came by the school, would drive by. They were there on the days when the bomb threats were called in to the school. But there was never actual contact on the school campus or at my house or at any point when I was in an area that could have been considered unsafe. Mm-hmm. What happened at that time, gang, I'm not sure, but the fact that this thing was going to happen was moving away any adversity that might have been out there in the air. Because universally, things happen, and sometimes they're not always good things that happen. But the negativity that could have been embedded in my mind never came. I was always positive about my direction. I always knew what I wanted, where I was going with this, and how I was going to get there. And I knew I had to reach the end point. Past that, the other stuff didn't matter. The Klan never mattered. The marches never mattered. Me coming on the campus at any time and maybe students, you know, wanting to have contact, never happened. I never gave them the opportunity to be combative. I think that was one thing. I never was in any controversial situations. I didn't allow myself. I was too busy trying to get the written word. What was important to me was important. And for some reason, there was this barrier that was around that kept me protected. And that is why it's so important to thank those people who were there for me, because I know they were part of it.
Mm-hmm. So after high school, were you involved in any civil rights activities?
And I talked about this with some student groups on the college campus. I left and I went to school in Tennessee at Fisk University. And there were a couple of groups that were, and I'm a real stickler about how things are formed and put together. And if I don't feel that they have a positive outcome, I don't want to be a part of it. Well, we were on a campus at Fisk during the time of the when King was assassinated. And that was in my freshman year at college. And there was a hamburger stand that was not too far from our dormitory. And on the night that he was assassinated, some of the students were involved with outsiders who burned this hamburger stand down. And I think when I heard about the students who did that, it was very painful because I gave them a little bit more respect than they showed me in forming union with something that I didn't approve of. Mm-hmm. So there were moments when I wouldn't participate because I knew better. And when you know better, you're supposed to do better. And there were times when I felt that how they were going about something was the wrong way. And they would always call me the median. At school, I was the median. If they wanted to know what was the right thing to do or if they should go further, they would always come and consult with me in my dormitory room. Well, what do you think about this? And even if I gave my opinion and they didn't like it, they would say, we knew you were going to say that anyway. So.
When you went to college, did you meet anybody who had the same type of background, the same history at being the first to integrate?
There were some who went maybe in northern schools, but it was different. They never had barriers. Let me put it like this. they broke the barriers based on them moving into a neighborhood, but it wasn't because they couldn't. The doors were always open. It's just that they move in a neighborhood that once was all white, because of their parents making more money, and they were able to enroll in the school. No constraints, no qualifications, nothing. You're in the neighborhood, boom, you can go to the school. But I never met anyone who was the first, not in my class, that would say that.
You know, it's one thing we haven't asked you. When you lived in Marietta, where did you live in Marietta? How?
I lived on Montgomery Street.
Okay.
I lived in a house that I have four brothers and a sister. I am next to the baby boy, so I was the baby girl, and I have a younger brother who, we're all old now. And I said, we're all still living. And I said, we're all old now. And we've all done things. I was talking to my oldest brother this morning. I said, you're the historian. He's doing our tree.
Okay.
And I said, you're the historian. So what is it that you think I can remember, or you can tell me that I can't remember that I did back then? And he said, well, you know, there were people who you didn't even know about that were making sure that you were okay. People in the white community that were saying, nobody needs to touch this little girl, because they knew your daddy, and your daddy worked with them in different capacities, or he drove for them, or he did certain things, and they were just out there. And he said, you need to understand that there was a group of supporters that you will never really know that made sure you were safe at the high school. And I said, wow, you're just not telling me. He said, yeah. He said, they promised your dad that they would make sure you were okay.
Can you talk to us a little bit about your dad?
My father was a father figure for me. He was with the family. He and my mother stayed together. They separated for a couple of years and realized that wasn't a good thing, and then they got back together. But he was there most of my growing up years. My father went to Stanford. He did 2 years at Stanford. He was in World War II, he fought in the Battle of the Bulge, a very intelligent black man who I felt in a different time, given different circumstances, he would have aspired to greater levels. But in my mind, he was bigger than life to me, and part of why I was able to do this. He was very proud of me. At both times, he was able to see me graduate high school and college. And I think that just seeing that pride on his face was more than any gift I could have ever given him. Mm-hmm. And he knew then that I was going to be all right in the world. Mm-hmm. He drowned, unfortunately, in Dallas, Georgia, at a lake. He was a fisherman. He loved fishing. And he went out one Saturday evening. In fact, my company was having a picnic, and I saw the company nurse walking toward me, and she said, I need to talk to you. And found out, she was telling me I needed to go home, found out my father had drowned. So, very just intuitive man, very knowledgeable. He was raised by his mother's sister. His mother died at childbirth. And he was raised with a cousin who went on to live in Japan. She set up a school, a stenography school in Japan. And listen at this, that my sister got an opportunity to visit because she married a serviceman, and they moved to Japan, and she was able to go and see the school. Mm-hmm. So it's a small world when you think about things that occur. So we've had some great backing coming through life that have allowed us to be good, productive human beings. And out of four brothers, three of them, all of them were married at one time, have produced children. My sister has two. And they were able to make good livings. Oldest brother is service retiree. Next to him, my brother was an entrepreneur. He had a club at one time and was in the insurance business. Mm-hmm. My third brother is, to this day, air conditioning, has his own air conditioning company. So.
Tell us a little bit about graduation day, and we'll, like, if you could tell, what were your parents like that day? Were they?
Wow. It was crazy because everybody wanted to bombard the house and be there. They wanted to go to the graduation. Friends and family were calling, and everybody wanted a peaceful graduation, and I just wanted to get to it. There was a lot of jubilant people, just happy. They had, even in the neighborhood, people had planned parties. They were so happy for me and for the people, the other students who had come and completed their education at Marietta High School. In fact, there was a program that they had at church that was very a recognition to say, you know, to honor us, and I thought that was so wonderful. All of the people were, all of the students were invited, and, you know, they made big, and I'm not a big person for any of that. I'm very shy. I mean, I know it may seem different, but I'm not a person that I like a lot of attention put upon me. I like to just do my thing, get out the way, and let the chips fall where they may. But graduation was awesome. Mm. There were other kids that were graduating from other schools that said, we want to be at your graduation. We want to be at your graduation. But I think there were about 300 of us that graduated from Marietta. And after they named me Girl of the Year, I think you couldn't take the smile off my face. And I think I cried most of the ceremony, but it was like, this is probably something I'll never forget. Mm-hmm. Never forget. And I think our class song was The Unreachable Star. And I can't get through that song now, today, because it just brings back so many memories.
Yeah.
But just amazing.
Yeah.
Just amazing. We were signing yearbooks, and everybody was saying, where are you going to school, blah, 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 you know. And it was just one of those times that any child should relish and remember as a good day in life. When you're graduating, you've completed that first stage of education, and now you're pre-qualified to go out there and see if you can make it through the other stage. So it's a wonderful time. And of course, I can't get past the gift giving. I mean, that's always a wonderful time.
Yeah.
To go home and know that people have dropped by and they were giving gifts, and here's some money, you know, for school and that kind of stuff. But it was a wonderful time.
Yeah.
Changing tracks just a little bit. I know Letty Williams, your aunt, was the first, or she was a librarian at Fort Hill before Hattie Wilson, right? Do you want to talk a little bit about
Aunt Letty? Oh, yes. Aunt Letty was sort of what I've become now in our family. If I think about the legacy that she left, she was one who, she did a lot of letter writing. It's where I got my powerful ability to write letters. She would often write letters during that time I was in school encouraging. and I wished I had some of them. And we, in fact, me and my brother were talking about the letters that she used to write. She was very powerful in her own way because we saw her as someone totally different from us, who was doing things that we thought, will we ever be able to do this? She lived in Washington, D.C. after she got out of the service. She worked for, I think it was called General Service something at that time, but she was a government worker. And she was bigger than life. I mean, when she came home, it was like we had to stop the world and just be at her beck and call, because she would talk to us in such a way that would allow us to know that, yeah, you can do this. There is a price. And she would tell us the stories about her being in the WAC. She would tell us about the travelings. And at that time, Aunt Letty was, her parents, there was a lot of mixed relations long years ago. And that was almost a point at which people thought she was more white than she was black. Therefore, her abilities to maneuver around were a lot greater than her relatives. Because if you see the pictures, to see her in person, she was not my aunt. And if we called her aunt in public, people would turn around and look at us, because like, are those kids crazy or what's going on? Because that's how much whiter she was than we were. Mm-hmm. Her sister, the same way. And my grandfather was the same way. My mother's father, which was Aunt Letty's sister, I mean her brother, he was a traveling musician. And Aunt Letty and Aunt Lula lived in Marietta long after he left. They never talked, and coming through, we never thought to ask about their mother or their father. And we would often ask our parents, well, who were they? And you know, they would tell us about their mother, but we never knew her per se. In fact, we didn't know our grandparents because they were dead when we got up to a certain age. But Aunt Letty was a whippersnapper.
How did she become involved with the library?
I think it was after she got out of service, because it used to be located in Lyman Homes, the projecting area. It was down under, and they needed someone to run the library. And that's how she got started. I don't know too much past that other than what I read, mm-hmm. also in her story, and some of what she would tell me, you know, as I would sit and listen to her. But she was very stoic in her manner, rigid. We were always at attention when we were in her company. I mean, it was like she was a little general. And she wielded the long stick. And it was sit up. We had to make sure the fork and the knife were on the right side. Manners were everything to her. You didn't talk back to adults in her company. She would ask, Mother, how are they doing? What are they doing? And she would do stuff like this at Christmas time, depending on what Mother said about us, you wouldn't get anything from her. Mm-hmm. She would send boxes, and it was nothing like getting a box from Aunt Letty. It was like, oh my God, if I don't get this box, she would send good stuff, you know. And it was like, there's no box for me or whatever. And it was like, woe is the world. And when she came home, she would always bring stuff from Washington, Bergdorf and Goodman's. I remember the stores because I remember the boxes. And I knew she was going to bring something, if it wasn't anything but a scarf. But it was just the fact that she would come home with all this stuff. and she would sit in a chair, and we would have to wait on her. As she pointed out, which box went to this person, which box went to that person. I mean, it was amazing. But quite a lady. And as she grew older, she ended up, I think, moving back to Georgia in like the, I'm going to say the early 80s. And she was much older. She ended up with emphysema because she smoked like a fool. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was one cigarette after the other. And we would try to convince her that they were killing her. She didn't want to have any of that. So she eventually died at Crawford Long Hospital from just, I think it was, I thought it would have been cancer, but they were saying that the emphysema had really just taken her out, so.
Dr. Wilburn Whittington, do you remember why he left Marietta?
No, I don't.
No. I actually tried to reach him yesterday.
Did you?
For an interview. Still trying. Still trying.
Wow. Is he still alive?
He was in Marietta as of 6 months ago.
Wow.
Yeah. He actually is Professor Emeritus of Ohio State University.
Wow.
He is at Ohio State University Medical School.
Wow.
He was also on the Board of Health for the City of Columbus. And needless to say, we're trying to find
him. That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. There are people in the community. Now I'll tell you somebody who, as I sit here and I think, and that was Mr. Scott. Mm-hmm. I don't know if y'all have had him.
Luke Scott. Mm-hmm. We're trying.
He has a lot of history about Marietta. Mm-hmm. He knew my mother and her sisters when they were young. They grew up together. And he always talked about the William girls. He has been a pillar of society for years. Mm-hmm. Still look the same, still going strong. Mm-hmm. Amazing man. Mm-hmm. Amazing. I think during the movement, civil rights movement, Mr. Scott was, he was visible, not very vocal, but supportive. And he always would tell me, I'm so proud of you. And he would say, if there's anything that you need, don't hesitate to come see me. I will help you out. You know I will. He always talked fast, walked fast. And it was just amazing to see Mr. Scott. And even to this day, if he's in the company of myself, we'd always go back and talk about, you know, during that time, how things went. And how he thought that there was going to be more than it was, but he said, just knowing who you were, I knew you were going to be able to carry it off. I knew you were. And he was so funny. He was a very funny man, but it's just amazing as you look around the community at the support and the non-support. Mm-hmm. You'd be surprised at the people who were just scared. They were just scared. Mm-hmm. Now that I think about it and look back at it, when you're young, you have no fear. You're just as gullible as you can be. And I wasn't really made to be fearful. I grew up with four boys. My sister was older, so you had to be tough. And my daddy would not take sides. He didn't make me any lesser than he did the boys, so I didn't know how to be afraid. If I wanted to survive with them, I had to do what they did, so. Mm-hmm.
Let me ask you this. If you had to do it again, would you do it?
Do it again.
Yeah.
No regrets. Mm-hmm. I would do it all over again. I would absolutely not hesitate. Yes, I would. There's something about a purpose in life. You are destined for something that you don't quite understand at the time, but you know that it is a part of who you are. And because of the predestined attitude, it is difficult for you to get past it. It is almost like there's a higher being saying, if you're obedient to this, the rest of your life will be just fine and wonderful. And I knew that that was part of how I was operating. I was operating under this whatever. And because of that, things did work out. I can truthfully say, because of the ability to stand while the wind was blowing real hard, it has helped me to stand even now. Because once you come past a certain age, you begin to be fretful of where you are in life. Mm-hmm. My thing with age now is, I don't know if I have enough time to do everything else I want to do. Mm-hmm. And there are so many more things that I'm looking forward to doing. I was the first in internal sales to generate $1 million. A first in being a manager at the company at Quest. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of firsts that were not really marketed because that's just who I am. Mm-hmm. But because I wanted to open doors for others, that's just me in life. And that's what I'll put on my epitaph or the book that I want to write. And I do want to write a book.
Oh, you should.
Yeah.
How long have you been working in Quest for?
Would you believe about 30 years?
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So that's about... So you started in the 70s there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Were you still living in Marietta at the time?
At the time, no.
Okay.
I was living in Atlanta.
You're down in Atlanta. Okay. What was it like working for them?
At the time, they were Smith Upjohn, mm-hmm. Upjohn Laboratories. And it was one of those where I used headhunters because I thought, let me let them work for me.
Mm-hmm.
And they found the job, and I interviewed and got it, working as a medical technologist. Mm-hmm. Learned a lot of stuff from Upjohn.
Mm-hmm.
And through different acquisitions, it changed to Smith Kline, and then finally to Quest, the largest laboratory in the country. Granted, I got a chemistry set when I was a young girl for Christmas. And one of the things that I told my mom was that I was going to work for the largest laboratory in the world.
Wow.
How prophetic.
Yeah, absolutely.
I did. And she reminded me of that. She said, you know, you used to always say you were going to work for the largest laboratory. And ultimately, Quest is overseas and everywhere, so...
Do you have any other questions? I have one question.
Okay,
sure.
What's the title of your book going to be?
Funny you should ask that, because I was talking to one of my colleagues at work, and she does a lot of writing,
mm-hmm.
and I was letting her preview the article that I sent to the Pitchfork, and she said, "Never let us know this at Quest. Why not?" And I said, because that's just my personality. She said, but as I sit here and I listen to you, she said, I was just crying. She was actually crying as I went through this, the little preview of what had transpired. And she said,
I can understand that.
What is it that you want to write about? I said, I'm not sure, but I said, I do know that this was a thing I had to do. She said, that's what your title should be, based around that. What you had to do.
Mm-hmm.
So some kind of way out of that, it will blossom. And my other really love is to do children's books. I have pieces.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I was just about to ask if there's anything else on your to-do list.
Yeah. have pieces of children's books that I want to get together. And I want to get free to do that, and I think I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think I am. So.
Thank you.
It's a lot this old girl wants to do.
That's right.
Well, you're really inspirational. And
yes, absolutely.
A tremendous
thank
amount
you.
In your life.
Thank you.
We thank you for your time today.
Yeah. Well, I thank you guys for allowing me to share.
Thank you for everything you did.
Well, I tell you, that's all I can say. Thank you so much.